Hey there, welcome to the Faces of Marketing podcast, where we talk about the human stories and lives of different people, perspectives in the marketing and creative profession. This is your host, Ryan Buchanan, and I'm here with senior strategist, Cher Fuller.
Hello.
Hey there. Cher is a dynamo and a global public speaker at growing digital marketing agency, Eroy, and Cher is the head coach of one of the top cheerleading squads in the world.
Mm-hmm.
What, and you, like, they've placed as high, like top 20 in the world.
Yeah, they've just got back from Worlds. They placed 9th in the Worlds.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, welcome to the show,
Cher. Thank
you. Yes. So cool. So we, in this podcast, we learn all about your story, and we start from the time of growing up as a kid. So want to know what your family's like, where you grew up. Tell us, kind of start there.
Yeah, I grew up in Corvallis, Oregon, and I actually kind of have a unique family story. My sister, my older sister, who's 40, has Down syndrome. And so I grew up in this world with all of these kids that were different than me and nonverbal and drooly and wanted to just hug all the time. And I didn't know that they were any different from me. So I kind of grew up in this cool world where everyone was different and everyone was special and it was celebrated. And my mom never allowed anybody to treat us differently. So it's been this cool perspective to kind of have in the world of accepting people's differences and being really open to all of the things that make us different.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So when you were, I want to go back to like your 8 or 10 year old self as Cher. So when, usually an adult would ask this question of like, all right, Cher, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what was your immediate honest answer to that?
So I was a gymnast my whole life, a competitive gymnast, and I used to listen to Phantom of the Opera in my room and make up routines. So I wanted to be a Broadway singer and dancer when I was a kid. That's the honest answer.
That is cool. But you didn't want to be like an Olympic gymnast.
No, I wanted to dance on Broadway.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Have you ever, did you ever go into acting?
Ever? Nope.
Okay. All right.
Childhood dreams.
Mm-hmm. And so, let's see. So you went, you went to high school in Corvallis.
Uh-huh.
And what, so you did gymnastics there. Like, what did you and your friends do on the week? Like, what was high school like?
Well, it's interesting. High school was kind of my transformative years where I left the sport of gymnastics because I was training so much and I realized that I wasn't going to football games and I wasn't going to dances and I didn't know what life was like outside of the gym. So in high school, I actually quit competitive gymnastics and then went into cheerleading at the high school so I could, you know, have a social life and meet friends. But in Corvallis, you go to barn parties. So that's what we would do on the weekends. We'd go to our friends.
Like square dancing and stuff?
No, like your friends.
Or keggers.
I mean, we weren't drinking in high school.
Of course. I mean, sorry.
Mom, we were not drinking in high school, but you would go to your friends. Like they had property out in Corvallis, out in the farmlands. And so we would go and have bonfires and music and dance. And it was
that's
just
cool.
So fun. Yeah.
That's cool. Cool. So, I am reflecting now on my oldest daughter who's in 10th grade, at Cleveland High School, and she is starting to tour colleges. We're starting a year early, but what was the decision of, you know, how you decided to go to Oregon State, which was probably a drive away from where you grew up, right?
Yeah, so I actually started at Portland State.
Okay.
So I was, by the time I was a senior, I was shopping around different colleges for scholarships for cheer. Because having a gymnastics background and tumbling, I was able to secure a few different offers from different colleges around the country. And my senior year, I actually ended up breaking my ankle and tearing all the ligaments. So I had complete reconstructive surgery. I got all of my scholarship offers revoked.
They can do that?
Yeah, they can. And so the coach at Portland State had seen me locally and said, we'll let you walk on with a scholarship and let you rehab and get back to, you know, back to healthy. So I took that. I did that. But it was great. Like living in Portland was awesome. I loved it. But I knew what college was supposed to feel like having grown up in Corvallis and gone to football games. And so it just didn't feel like college to me. So after 2 years, I actually transferred to Oregon State. Which was great. I mean, I I love Corvallis. I love Oregon State. I love the Beavers. And so it felt really good to go, kind of go back home, be on that cheer team down there and like support my homegrown, like, you know, territory.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I know we're jumping ahead, but you obviously love that mentoring, well, really K through 12, right?
Yeah.
But because I was going to go to this notion of this transformative time in your life is this middle school, high school scenario. And so you've stayed connected to that work through coaching, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I've worked with kids. I mean, yeah, K through 12, even now that my kids have gone into college, for the past 15, 16 years, especially with coaching. And I love it. I love being part of their lives, helping mold where they're going and being this, a strong female that's kind of been in their shoes and can speak to them like a human and understand their struggles with athletics and what they're dealing with. And I think it's kids are living in a time frame that none of us have ever had exposure to. So the digital issues that they're dealing with and just the way that they communicate is fascinating to me as a marketer, but then in turn to see how it impacts their life and how we can help them kind of overcome some of that adversities and dealing with this different landscape it's amazing.
Yeah. Cause I mean, my two daughters, 7th and 10th grade, and their friend groups, like the number of cases of their friends with like extreme anxiety breakdowns and things like that, that I think social media is helping to cause this whole fear of missing out and things like that. Like,
yeah.
Do you see more of that with your kids in cheer and stuff or their friends or things like that?
Yeah, it's interesting because so my kids are in competitive cheerleading. It's a club. And across the country, because they're so competitive, they have a following. So a lot of my kids will have like 60,000 followers on Instagram.
What?
Yeah. And so they're kind of like their own little celebrities, and they have this, it's interesting to watch 14, 15, 16 year olds have this public persona that they know they have to put forward because that's the image that they want to, you know, convey to the world. And it's interesting. It's interesting to watch companies and brands approach them because they see their following and they want them to start endorsing their products. And, you know, so to sit down with a 14 year old and say, you know, you need to slow down. Like, let's not just take every offer that comes our way. To even be having those kind of conversations is crazy right now. And just the social validation that they need in order to have this curated life online, to look perfect and to look like they're going and doing all of these great, crazy things. You know, it's a life that never existed for us before.
Yeah. I can't even imagine that. It's crazy. Uh-huh. Okay. So going back to you in college, what did you study? Like, what were you in? What did you major in?
Yeah. I was speech communications with an emphasis in visual rhetoric. So at Oregon State, there isn't an advertising category like there is at Oregon. And so visual rhetoric is the study of, you know, why people are attracted to visual things that they like. It's kind of the closest thing that we have to advertising. And I had always, my dad owns a small business in Corvallis, and so I'd always kind of known that I wanted to be involved in some type of marketing or some type of aspect in that regard. But once I started doing the visual rhetoric classes at Oregon State, it was so interesting to me, and it was something that I just found that I really wanted to know more about and get into.
That's awesome. Okay, so then you got your first job out of college is often either really hard to get or this circuitous path to start, you know, in retail or something, you know, and then you find your way. So what was that first job and then first quote unquote real job?
Yeah. So I graduated in 2008 when there was nothing available. Like, the market was crashing. No, there was just no jobs available. And I actually started nannying for a family that was the older sister of my high school ex-boyfriend. And the mom and the dad actually both worked in the advertising industry. So it was, you know, it was cool. Like, I got paid to do this, like, set up the slip and slide and hang out during the summers. And then, you know, I kind of got to see the behind the scenes of what they were doing at their agencies and bringing the kids in and talking to them. And the mom, who continues to be a huge mentor to me, was just like, I think this is something you would really be, you know, great at. And so she kind of helped me and mentored me along of the ins and outs of the industry and how to get into it. So she was a huge, you know, hero for me in terms of helping me walk into this industry and setting expectations.
Cool, cool. So doing my LinkedIn sleuthing, was your first agency job at Opus?
It was, yeah, okay. Opus Creative.
And what did you do for them? And then where did it springboard after that?
I started Opus Creative as an account coordinator, so I knew nothing. I was working on Intel and Nike, helping out where I could. And then I ended up getting promoted to a producer role at Opus, and I'd always been really interested in social media and kind of what was going on in that world. And it sounds funny to say it now, but at the time, like, a social strategist, that job didn't exist. Like, people were like, social media is just this thing that college kids are doing. And so it wasn't really being given the credit that it
the
is
Facebook.
Now. The Facebook, yeah. Which, yeah. And so I was running their social media for the company, and I just knew that it was something I was really interested in. I wanted to keep pursuing. And, you know, as most small agencies are, there's kind of just limits and where you can go and what kind of different jobs you can pursue. And so I actually ended up just setting kind of a top five dream list of agencies that I'd want to work with in Portland, and sent my resume out unsolicited and just said, if there's ever a role you think I'd be a good fit for, I'd love to sit down and have a conversation. And out of that, I was given an opportunity, an offer at Instrument to come in and work with them.
And they happen to be one of the hottest agencies in Portland. So that was pretty cool to be on the ground floor. And you were helping them market themselves, which a lot of agencies don't do a good job at.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah. So I was an internal producer strategist role, essentially, for them, helping them figure out how they were talking about themselves, what kind of work they were submitting for different awards, and just really any of the internal functions that we were having. So any of the Design Week events or any just public facing agenda that we had, I was helping run.
And then you found your way over to Eroy.
I did.
And what can you describe to the audience, like, strategy seems like so kind of squishy and amorphous and like everyone's in their head is a strategist, but like, what is the tangible piece of what strategy does?
The way I like to explain it to people, the easiest way is kind of, you know, we are writing the blueprints for the house. You can't build the house until you have that foundation, until you understand what the structure is looking like. And so a lot of strategies work is done in research and insights to dig out what are the opportunities that are going to set our creative team up for success. And so, you know, it's my job essentially working, I work full-time on Taco Bell, to understand our audience, where they are, what kind of media they're consuming, where they're at, what they're interested in, what are the current trends, so that when we do create content, it's, you know, it's captivating and it's enticing people to do whatever that end goal is that we have for our business partners.
Cool. And then you also recently worked on a pitch and some of the early work with Bay Equity, which most folks don't know about because it's a mortgage company, but I thought it was pretty cool that this old school industry is trying to relate to the new school and like this millennial audience. And you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, like I kind of alluded to before, we're dealing with an upcoming generation that knows, like, does not know life without the internet. And so as a result, you know, we have this upcoming group of people right behind. We have the millennials and we have Gen Z. Right now, we're really focusing on the millennial group that is more tech forward. And so companies need to accept that and evolve with it. And so it's really interesting to work with a company that understands that and is backing that logic and building that into their branding. So a company that is providing home loans to get people into their, you know, their forever home, like such an important part of their life that, you know, they're going to raise their families in these homes. They're going to spend, you know, their first time, like, you know, in the garage, marking the height, you know, of their kids. It's fascinating to have a brand that's so understanding of their audience and willing to adapt so that they can meet the needs of the people that they're talking to.
That's cool. So maybe if you could pick one example, and it doesn't have to be Eddie, right? But like in your career of a project that you're just really proud of, and that was, and it doesn't even have to be a client. It could be just an internal project, anything that you're really, that was, that really sung to your heart.
I think still to this day, it's an oldie but a goodie. We did the launch strategy for Taco Bell's loyalty program, and I was terrified to pitch this project because it was so outside of the box, and it was so, you know, I just, that's kind of the risk with strategy, is you are trying to get people to buy into your ideas. You're not, you have nothing really to tangibly give them except a belief and a dream. And so to pitch this idea that was just so crazy, like so outside of the box of, you know, we were going to do this road trip down the coast of California, and the people that we were going to be using in the social campaign, we're going to be demonstrating how you play the game by not really telling people, but showing them. There's just so many intricate things that were happening in this plan, and I'd never pitched anything this big before. And so it just, you know, I kind of had to have this moment where I was like, you have to 100% believe with conviction, like, this plan that you're putting forth, because you know it's going to work. Like, I know this is going to work. I just have to get them to believe it too. And it ended up being a huge success. They loved it. They, you know, awarded us the project, and it was just, it was so much fun. It was honestly one of the, like, the hardest, most frustrating, longest hours, most rewarding, funnest project of my life.
And we were stepping into territory that was a little unknown, like Snapchat celebrities, and you just jumped in with both feet.
Yeah, I know that world.
Yeah, maybe newer to some of us. Yeah.
Cool. I do remember explaining Snapchat to some of the older people on the account, like, no. So it goes away in 24 hours. You can't just have it up.
All right. I'm dating myself. And we're moving on. So inspiration, do you get that mainly from a couple people and blogs that you look to? Do you get that from the environment of driving into work? Like, where do you mainly get that, and like specifically who or what?
I mean, honestly, I would say my biggest inspiration comes from the kids that I work with. It's to hear from like the mouths of these kids what either they're dealing with, they're excited about, they're interested in, they're, you know, recreating. Like, I would rather hear it from the people than read it from a reporter that's putting something in a blog. And it's nice to have the justification to back up what I'm hearing or what I'm seeing, especially since, you know, I can't take a group of localized kids and think that that's going to be thinking that could be replicated across the country. So it is interesting to have those insights, but then to be able to back them up nationally by, you know, different things that I'm reading online. And honestly, I mean, I wouldn't say that there's a specific blog that I go to get information, but you know, even just from Instagram, like, there's so many great accounts that aren't just posting content. I mean, BuzzFeed is like completely backed themselves with credibility in the past couple of years, which is just like, it's a crazy evolution. But, you know, they have so many different Instagram channels for news and food and beauty. And so sometimes I'm even getting my news just from Instagram. And so following brands that are posting stuff, seeing what kind of celebrities they're working with, seeing the content that they're producing, different street artists and what kind of murals they're putting up. I think, you know, and it stems back to the earlier question of, you know, how did I grow up? I grew up in a world that was different and weird and crazy. And I take my inspiration from so many different sources. I don't really take them from the marketing world. I take them from what's actually happening out in, you know, in everyday life. That's what inspires me, real people.
I love that. That's awesome. So that's a great segue to, what do you think consumers are going to feel in 3 to 5 years that is from brands that is different than now? Like,
yeah,
you know, you look at how marketing and technology and all of these things are mashing up together. Like, how are people going to experience things when they buy that influences them to buy something or go somewhere?
I think that it's an interesting question. I actually was just talking to a group of people about this at our Design Week event because we were focusing on Gen Z. So, you know, 2 years old to 17 years old. And it's interesting to look at what their normal is. So what is normal is the information that's at my fingertips of what I can collect without having to talk to anyone. And that's normal. I mean, you're seeing iPads being introduced into schools. You're like, kids are being pushed onto technology, and rightfully so. But I do think that it's going to be interesting in the next 3 to 5 years for brands to recognize that the data is important in which they are collecting, but they still need to recognize people as human beings that have individual preferences. So I think that it's going to be really important to kind of, because the normal is technology and online, I think it's going to be important for people to, or for brands to start to introduce more in-person experiential types of marketing, because people aren't dumb. This whole thing, you know, this whole deal that's happening with Facebook right now about data, it's ignorant to think that companies haven't been collecting your data for years. But we know that as marketers. I would say the average consumer doesn't know that or didn't want to know that. And this has been a huge wake-up call of all of the things that exist online that are being collected for them. And so I think that I don't think that trend will ever go away. We're always going to be able to collect, and it's going to be able to provide us with a lot more ways to customize and create different preferences for people. But I think real touch, real human interaction, finding ways for people to connect outside of the technology that they're so used to is going to almost kind of become more of something that's exclusive because it's so different from what people are being trained to do currently.
So basically, like, you super immersive, like, entertainment-like scenarios in retail stores that you can only get in person, mm-hmm. versus, you know, experiencing it digitally. That kind of stuff is what we'll see more of?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting right now, this image, or the time we're living in of Instagram, where you can see anything. I mean, I can go on Snapchat right now. I could go on Snap Maps. I could go to South Africa. I could see where the red hot spots are of where people are posting content, and I could see what people are posting. So that's not new. Like, being able to see things and find things online and see what people are doing and to kind of have this voyeuristic, invasive look into people's lives, that's normal for us now. And it's weird. Like, it freaks people out when I show them my Snap Map and I'm like, oh, I know where all my kids are, like at the gym. I can see if they're at school. I know where, you know, that's weird to us, but it's not weird to them. And so I predict that this upcoming generation is going to, instead of wanting to see it, and, you know, almost this idea of FOMO, instead of seeing it online or seeing it through a screen, it's going to become much more about actually being there and experiencing it. And, you know, in a weird way, the bragging rights of actually experiencing things in person, because the technology is so rampant for everyone else. It's so accessible. So how do you create exclusivity for people in an age where everything is accessible?
I like it. Last question. Tell us something the audience probably doesn't know about you. And what I mean specifically about that is something that happened to you maybe earlier in life that was foundational to put you on the trajectory that you're on now, to kind of help you get to where you are now. Whether it is just a personal thing, like, that gave you confidence, or like that something big that happened, and maybe people know about it, but the audience doesn't know it about you.
Oh, man. I would say, and this... this is going to be a heavy one, but I dealt with a family member's suicide a few years ago. I was very, very close to what happened, the situation, helping people through it. And as a result, we've had some family issues where family is kind of separated. And I will say that one of the reasons why I am so passionate about the way social media connects people and the way it brings them together is I have this whole side of my family, cousins that are, you know, 20 and below that I can only communicate with through technology because we're not allowed to see each other just because of the fallout of everything. And so it's I will always side with kids on how they're using technology because I'm watching the way my family members are using it and the way that we're able to stay connected and keep that family bond. And so I think, a lot of times people don't understand why kids are using social media the way they are or how they can have these kind of, how are they able to even forge these relationships? Well, I can tell you that I've maintained a relationship with this family that I've not been allowed to see for years because of the technology. And I will forever be grateful for that. So I think it's given me more empathy towards a platform that I think a lot of people haven't been able to find the meaning in because they haven't been forced to find the meaning in it yet.
I really appreciate you sharing all of this, especially the last part. And thanks for being on the show, Sherry.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Ryan.
All right. Cheers.